Good morning, everyone. I send you greetings from the Long Grove Community Church of Door County, Wisconsin, where God has broken out his palette of colors in brilliant and astounding ways. But I'm very pleased that I can, through technology, share with you a continuing part of our study of 1 Peter, and that's what we're going to do this morning. I recently read a different take on Genesis. Specifically, chapter 2, it has shaken my long-standing understanding of how things, well, what happened in the early days of God's creation. I'd like to read this account to you. And Adam said, "Lord, when I was in the garden, you walked with me every day. Now I do not see you anymore. I am lonesome here, and it's difficult for me to remember how much you love me." And God said, "No problem. I will create a companion for you that will be with you forever and who will be a reflection of my love for you, so that you will know I love you even when you cannot see me. Regardless of how selfish and childish and unlovable you may be, this companion will accept you as you are and will love you as I do, in spite of yourself." I know where you think this is going, but don't go there yet. "And God created a new animal to be a companion for Adam, and it was a good animal. And God was pleased, and the new animal was pleased to be with Adam, and he wagged his tail. And Adam said, 'But Lord, I have already named all the animals in the kingdom, and all the good names are taken, and I cannot think of a name for this new animal.' And God said, 'No problem. Because I have created this new animal to be a reflection of my love for you. His name will be a reflection of my own name, and you will call him Dog.' And Dog lived with Adam and was a companion to him and loved him. And Adam was comforted, and God was pleased. And Dog was content and wagged his tail. After a while, it came to pass that the angel Gideon came to the Lord and said, 'Lord, Adam has become filled with pride. He struts and preens like a peacock, and he believes he is worthy of adoration. Dog has indeed taught him that he is loved, but no one has taught him humility.' And the Lord said, 'No problem. I will create for him a companion who will be with him forever and who will see him as he is. The companion will remind him of his limitations, so he will know that he is not worthy of adoration.'" Don't go where I think you're going. "And so God created Cat to be a companion to Adam. And Cat would not obey Adam. And when Adam gazed into Cat's eyes, he was reminded that he was not the supreme being. And Adam learned humility. And God was pleased. And Adam was greatly improved. And Cat, he did not care one way or the other." Kind of a humorous way of introducing our topic for today, which is humility. I don't know where that came from, but I enjoyed it when I read it. I hope you enjoyed it. But the theme for our text today really is centered around the idea of humility. And specifically, we're looking at 1 Peter chapter 5, 5 through 7. And so if you'll follow with me, I'm going to read beginning with verse 5. "In the same way, you who are younger, submit yourselves to your elders. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud but shows favor to the humble. Humble yourself, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. Cast all your anxiety on him, because he cares for you." Humility. Humility is not a very popular trait in the modern world. It's not touted on talk shows or celebrated in valedictorian speeches or commended in diversity seminars or listed with core values. And if you go to some self-help section in a major bookstore, you won't find many books on the topic of humility. You may find one or two in the religious or spiritual faith section, but not in the self-help section. And the reason for this is it's not that hard to find, because humility can only survive in the presence of God. When God goes, humility goes. In fact, you might say that humility follows God like a shadow follows the image of a person. We can expect to find humility applauded in our society as often as we find God is applauded, which means in today's society, not very much. A major newspaper carried an editorial that captured the cultural atmosphere which seems to have strangled humility. The editor wrote this: "There are some who naively cling to the nostalgic memory of God. The average churchgoer takes a few hours out of the week to experience the sacred, but the rest of the time he is immersed in a society that no longer acknowledges God as an omniscient and omnipotent force to be loved and worshiped. Today, we are too sophisticated for God. We can stand on our own. We are prepared and ready to choose and define our own existence." In this cultural atmosphere, humility cannot survive. It disappears as God disappears. And when God is neglected, then the runner-up God, small g, takes his place. And that small god is namely man, or even more specifically, pride. So that the atmosphere of our culture, the atmosphere of our world that we breathe, it's hostile to humility. And this text that we read just a few moments ago is utterly foreign to our world, to our times. And yet it is utterly necessary. If what is said here doesn't take root in our lives, then we will not be the Christian church. And we will not be salt and light for an ever perishing world. So let's take our text and let's break it down on this theme of humility. And the first thing that I want us to note is that humility is essential to the Christian life. The main point of this whole passage is that we Christians should be a humble people. Three times the command comes in one form or another to be humble. In verse 5, younger men be subject, or in other words, be humble toward your elders. Also in verse 5, all of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. And then in verse 6, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. So the main point of our text is simply, in these three verses, humility is an essential part of the Christian life. In other words, it is the defining mark of a true Christian. Humility. It was Augustine who wrote this: "When a certain rhetorician was asked what was the chief rule of eloquence, he replied, 'Delivery.' Well, what was the second rule? 'Delivery.' And what was the third rule? 'Delivery.' So if you ask me," that is Augustine saying this, "if you ask me concerning the precepts of the Christian religion, the first, second, third, and always principle is humility. 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 Humility is the defining mark of a true Christian. Now, why should we care or seek humility beyond the fact that we're commanded to be humble? Well, Peter gives us four incentives for humility right here in our text. There are others, but I just want to focus on our text. Four incentives for humility. And number one, verse 5, God is opposed to the proud. Nothing could be worse than to be in the position where an infinitely powerful and holy God is opposed to you. So therefore, don't be proud. The second incentive is also found in verse 5. God gives grace to the humble. And so therefore, nothing could be better than to have an infinitely powerful and wise God to treat us graciously. And the word says he does that to those who are humble. So the reason is not that humility is a performance of a virtue, or in other words, you've earned the grace. That's not it. It's just that humility is that profession of emptiness that must be filled with the grace of God. Blessed are the poor in spirit, Jesus said. Blessed are the humble, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The third incentive for humility is that God will use his mighty hand to exalt the humble. That's in verse 6. It says, "Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time," or in due time. He is exalting you in his time. It's an incentive for humility, to be exalted by God. By that same infinitely powerful and wise God to exalt you? The fourth incentive is found in verse 7. God will use his mighty hand to care for the humble. Verse 7 says, casting all your anxiety upon him because he cares for you. So be a humble person, because if you are proud, God will be against you in your pride. But if you are humble, he will give you grace. He will exalt you in his time, in due time, and he will care for you along the way so that you do not have to be anxious about life. And so that's the basic message of the text. But as is often true in the text, the question still remains in our minds, well, how? How will this take root in our minds and our hearts? How will humility make a powerful difference in the way that we live in order that we can bring honor and glory to God? Well, I'm going to help us dive deeper into this topic of humility by asking two questions. And the first question is, what is pride and humility? And the second question, coming directly out of our text, is this: what is the connection between humility and not being anxious? You notice that the sermon title is Don't Worry, Be Humble. What's the connection? Now, I'm going to start with that second question first in our delving more deeply into this topic of humility. How do humility and not being anxious relate to each other? The reason that they are related to each other is because in verses 6 and 7, there is a grammatical connection. Unfortunately, the NIV does not show it. The English Standard Version does, and many of the other translations, but there's a grammatical connection. It says, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time. And the NIV says, period, cast all your cares or all your anxiety. But in the best translation, it says this. It says, that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety upon him because he cares for you. That's a tremendously different thing. It's not a new sentence in verse 7. It is what we call a subordinate clause. In other words, humble yourselves. How? By casting your anxieties on him. I think this means that casting your anxieties on God is an expression of humility. It's like saying, eat politely. How? Chew with your mouth shut. Drive carefully. How? Looking both directions before you pull out into the lane of traffic. Be generous. How? By inviting someone over on Thanksgiving. Humble yourselves. How? By casting your anxieties on God. So one way to be humble is to cast your anxieties upon him, which means that one of the hindrances to casting your anxieties on God is pride. Pride. Which, if you continue the thinking, if you extrapolate the reasoning, then undue worry about your future is probably a form of pride. C.S. Lewis wrote this. He says, the vice I'm talking about is pride or self-conceit, and the virtue of opposite to it in Christian morals is called humility. According to Christian teachers, the essential vice, the utmost evil, is pride. Unchastity, anger, greed, drunkenness, and all that are mere flea bites in comparison. It was through pride that the devil became the devil. Pride leads to every other vice. Is worry a vice? Well, maybe not in the same category of others that we can think of, but Jesus commanded us not to worry. So to worry is a violation of one of his commandments, so it's wrong. And all that C.S. Lewis is saying is that pride is what leads to the wrongness of our life, including worry. Undue worry. Now, there's a lot more that can be said about that, but to feel the full force of what we're trying to say here, I want to go back and now answer the first question, and then we'll come back to this connection between anxiety or worry and humility. So the first question that I asked was, what is pride and humility? And I'm going to give you 10 biblical observations about pride, and humility is the opposite of each of these, and I am in debt. Candidly, I am, and confessingly, I am in debt to a number of other preachers and teachers in the compiling of this list. 10 biblical observations about pride. Number one, pride is self-satisfaction. And I'm going to give you some verses to go along with it. I'll read the verses. They're not going to be on the screen, but you can write them down. Hosea chapter 13, verses 4 and 6. I have seen the Lord your God. I have been the Lord your God since the land of Egypt. I cared for you in the wilderness in the land of drought. As they had their pasture, they became satisfied, and being satisfied, their heart became proud. Therefore, they forgot me. Pride is self-satisfaction. The second observation is pride is self-sufficiency and self-reliance. In Deuteronomy chapter 8, Moses warns the people of God about what will happen when they finally have rest in the promised land. Here's his warning. He says, "Beware, lest when you have eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and gold multiply, then your heart becomes proud and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt. And you say in your heart, 'My power and the strength of my hand made me this wealth.'" In other words, pride takes God's goodness and turns it into self-sufficiency. The third observation is pride considers itself above instruction. Doesn't need anybody giving them any instruction. Jeremiah chapter 13, verses 9 and 10, God says to the people of Judah, "I will destroy the pride of Judah and the great pride of Jerusalem. This wicked people who refuse to listen to my words, who walk in the stubbornness of their hearts." Pride stubbornly refuses to be taught by the ways of God, by the word of God, and makes its own wishes and desires the standard of truth. Fourth observation is that pride is insubordinate. Psalm 119:21, the psalmist writes this, "You rebuke the arrogant who are accursed, those who stray from your commands." When the commands and the commandments of God are spoken, pride turns away and will not submit to them. It rejects the right and authority of God to command, of God to demand. The fifth observation of pride is that pride takes credit for what God alone has done. One of the most vivid illustrations of that is in the case of Nebuchadnezzar. We looked at this when we were preaching through Daniel, maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago. He was the king of Babylon. And in Daniel chapter 4, he says this, "Is this not Babylon the great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty?" The scripture goes on and says, "While the word was in the king's mouth, even as he is saying this, a voice came from heaven saying, 'King Nebuchadnezzar, sovereignty has been removed from you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it upon whomever he wishes.'" You might recall there was a season of humiliation where Nebuchadnezzar is grazing in the fields like a wild animal. And ultimately he confesses and is restored. And in Daniel chapter 4, verse 37, it says this, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are true and his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride." Pride takes credit for what God has done. Number six, pride delights in being made much of. Jesus himself indicted the religious folks, the religious know-it-alls in Jerusalem, when in Matthew 23, verse 6, he says, "And they," that is, these religious know-it-alls, "they love the place of honor at banquets and the chief seats in the synagogues and respectful greetings in the marketplaces and being called by men rabbi." He's not commending them. He's not describing factually, although it's factual. He was condemning them because they loved being made much of. They loved having a fuss over them. Number seven, pride aspires to be the place of God. I don't know if you recall the story of Herod in Acts chapter 12, but he was the sitting ruler of Jerusalem and Israel under the authority of the Roman Empire. And on an appointed day, the scripture says in Acts chapter 12, on an appointed day, Herod, having put on his royal apparel, took his seat on the rostrum and began delivering an address to them, meaning the people. And the people kept crying out, "The voice of a god and not of a man." And immediately an angel of the Lord struck him because he did not give God the glory. And he was eaten by worms and died. Pride ceased to take the place of God. Number 8, pride opposes the very existence of God. Psalm 10, verse 4, the wicked in the haughtiness of his countenance does not seek him, meaning God, and his thoughts are, there is no God. Pride knows that the simplest solution for its own survival would be that there's no God. C.S. Lewis says that pride is the complete anti-God state of mind. And since pride opposes the very existence of God, it should not surprise us that the ninth biblical observation of pride is that pride refuses to trust in God. Proverbs 28:25 contrasts arrogance and trust. Listen to what he writes. An arrogant man stirs up strife, but he who trusts in the Lord will prosper. Pride cannot trust God. The posture of trust is far too weak for someone who's prideful. Too dependent. It calls attention too much to the strength and the wisdom of someone other than yourself. Trusting God is the heartbeat of humility. It is the opposite of pride. When pride keeps us from trusting in God to take care of us, then there's two possibilities that can happen. One is that we feel a false security based upon our own imagined power and shrewdness and abilities to avert catastrophes or disappointments or terrible situations. The other possibility is that we realize we cannot guarantee our own security, and so we feel anxious. We start to worry. We start to despair. So pride refuses to trust in God, which leads us to the final observation biblically of pride, and that is pride is anxious about the future. In Isaiah chapter 51, verses 12 and 13, God says to a very anxious Israel that their problem is pride. He says in verse 12, I, even I, am he who comforts you. Who are you that you are afraid of man who dies and of the Son of Man who is made like grass, that you have forgotten the Lord your Maker? In other words, who do you think you are, Israel, to be afraid? You've forgotten me. To be afraid of the future. I am the future. Now, it sounds strange, but that's how subtle pride can be. Pride is at the root of our anxiety. It is at the root of worry. And so now if we kind of bring all of this together, and I hope that you can see the full force of 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 6 and 7. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time. How? How, in what way shall you humble yourselves? Answer verse 7, by casting all your anxiety upon him. Why? Because he cares for you. In other words, the humblest thing in the world that you can do is to do what 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 19 says. Entrust your soul to a faithful Creator. Cast your anxiety upon the one who cares for you. Casting your anxieties on God means trusting the promise that he cares for you and has the power and the wisdom to put that care to work in the most glorious way in your life. And that trust, my friends, is the opposite of pride. It's the essence of humility. It's the confidence that the mighty hand of God is not over you to crush you, but to care for you, just like the promise says. And this is a promise here in chapter 5. So don't be proud, but cast your anxieties on him because why? He will care for you. So whenever your heart starts to get anxious, whenever you find yourself becoming a little overwhelmed with worry about your future or about someone else that you care about, then preach to yourself. Heart, who do you think you are to be afraid of the future and nullify the promise of God? No, heart. I will not exalt myself with anxiety. I will humble myself in peace and joy as I trust this precious and great promise of God to take care of me. Why? Because he cares for me. That's humility. It's one facet of humility. Not being anxious, but trusting. Don't worry. Humble. But there's more to humility than casting aside anxiety. And so I just want to take a slight discursus here on humility and just kind of broaden our understanding of humility. Because humble people are not always what we think they ought to be. They aren't always modest. They aren't always agreeable. They're not always submissive. They aren't always nice, at least not in the ways that we project or that we think they should be, that we think those qualities are supposed to look like in a humble person. I do think we find humility typically attractive when we recognize it. I just don't think we always recognize it. Sometimes we mistake humility for pride and pride for humility. And truth be told, we don't always like to be around humble people. So let me take a quick tour with you on humility, what it is, or what do people who are humble look like, at least how we should hopefully think they should look like. I'm going to give you four additional characteristics besides the idea of not worrying or being anxious. Another characteristic of humility is humble people don't think much of themselves. Now, most of us would agree that a humble person who doesn't is someone that doesn't think much of themselves. But often we have in mind the idea that it's self-deprecation, that humble people think of themselves as lowly and worthless. And in one sense, there's a truth to that, but that's not really what I'm talking about. You see, to think of ourselves as lowly is true when we see ourselves in view of God's holiness and our sinfulness, and so that we shouldn't think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think in relative to the personhood of God or Christ. Their healthy, proportionate view of their own depravity causes them to consider others more important than themselves. But Andrew Murray really gets at what I think I mean by a humble person doesn't think much of themselves. When he says this, Andrew Murray was a giant of the faith of years gone by. And he wrote this: a humble person is not one who thinks meanly of himself. He simply does not think of himself at all. As I said, self-deprecation isn't the primary trait of humility. The primary trait of humble people is they just don't have to think much of themselves. Meaning they're not self-preoccupied, that they have a better, higher, more glorious thing to be occupied with in their minds and their hearts. And I think we can find this trait very refreshing, because humble people, seeing all things in relationship to God, they're looking for what? They're looking to enjoy those things. They're looking for God's glory in those things. And this allows them to be the most fully enjoyable of God people on the planet. And when you're with them, when you're with this kind of person, that they're not thinking of themselves, but they're thinking of the glory of God and all that they see and all that they're experiencing, then there's nothing, when you're with them and you begin to forget about yourself, is that not refreshing when you don't have to think about yourself? When you forget yourself just for a little while, why? Because you're absorbed into something that is far more glorious than our little piece of the universe. But I think we also can find this kind of a trait to be convicting, because it exposes us to our own self-obsession. We're so used to people, especially ourselves, being self-conscious and self-centered, that when we're with people like that, when we're with people that are not like that, I should say, then we are become more aware of our own tendency to be self-absorbed. Another characteristic of humble people, another characteristic, is that they do not think much of themselves. The second characteristic, or maybe the third if you include anxiety or not having anxiety, is that humble people prefer windows to mirrors. Windows to mirrors. In other words, not thinking much of themselves means that the humble person prefers to look through a window, not look at a mirror. They desire to see the glory of God in everything, and it frees them from needing to see how everything else reflects on them. I don't want a mirror, I want a window. Humble people view other people as God's marvelous image bearers, windows to God's glory, not as mirrors that enhance or diminish our own self-image. This also means that they are not absorbed with how others view them. So they aren't worried about reading the right books, seeing the right movie, listening to the right music, living in the right house, having the right job, being seen with the right people. That's a mirror mindset. They view those, we can view those things, if we're humble people, as windows to see the movement of God, the pleasure of God, the glory of God. A third characteristic, or a fourth of humble peoples. They're authentically countercultural. Countercultural. This means that humble people are authentically living against the flow of culture. A culture that's compromised of pride-infected people produces a lot of pressure, a lot of pressure for people to conform to those cultural expectations. And a lot of that poses as nonconformity when in reality, they're thinking that they're not conforming is really they're conforming to a sub-part of the culture, an acceptable part of the culture. Nothing more than an attempt to fit into the group. Humble people, they're unaffected, usually, they're unusually unaffected by the pressure to conform. They can be hard to categorize because they don't fit neatly into culture's mold or culture's categories. They tend to have disdain and not fit into the trends of that day, whether it's fashion or interests or whatever. They're not looking to have their personal brand out there. They have preferences about things like that, but they hold those preferences as a way of enjoying God's manifold goodness rather than being image enhancers. It's this lack of self-preoccupation that really can run counter to our culture or subcultures that people who are humble, they live in that. They live in that lack of self-preoccupation. And so that deficit that they have of self-importance usually isn't considered cool by culture. In fact, when you live counterculturally as a humble person, it makes you look weird and odd. And that doesn't bother the humble man or woman. The fourth or the fifth characteristic of a humble person is they're offensive. This one is one that can surprise us about a truly humble man or woman. And we can mistake this offensiveness as pride. But the fact of the matter is, some humble people can be very offensive. You see, humble people, what I'm saying is that they're without guile. They're without this personal agenda that seeks to promote themselves or pretense of something about themselves or to defend themselves. In other words, they say things like they are, and by saying it like they are, it can sting, and it can even sound condemning. I hope no one would argue with me, but the most humble person to ever walk the planet of the earth was Jesus Christ. Boy, could he fling some zingers. He called the religious leaders a brood of vipers in Matthew chapter 12. He called them sons of the devil in John chapter 8. He called the crowd and even some of his own disciples faithless and a twisted generation, Matthew 17. Humble Paul publicly rebuked Peter in Galatians chapter 2. He told the Galatians that they were foolish. Would you like me to stand up here as your pastor and just say, you bunch of fools? They were not nice things to say. Nice things to say. Humble people don't always say nice things. They say honest things. And that honesty sometimes can have a sharp edge. It might even feel like it's left a wound. And so because of this, that humble person could be accused of pride, but there is a qualitative difference between the offensiveness of the proud and the offensiveness of the humble. The proud offend to exalt or defend themselves or try to control and manipulate others. The humble offend in order to advance the truth for the glory of God and for the ultimate good of that other. Let me say that again. The proud offend to exalt or defend themselves and or to control or manipulate others. The humble offend in order to advance the truth for the glory of God and the ultimate good of others. Humble offensiveness may not be popular, but it is always God-directed and loving. King David knew this. That's why he wrote in Psalm 141:5, "Let a righteous man strike me, it is a kindness. Let him rebuke me, it is oil for my head," meaning a refreshment. Solomon, the son of David, knew this. He wrote in Proverbs 27:6, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, profuse are the kisses of an enemy." Humility can wound and pride can kiss. Kisses may feel better than a wound at first, but later the wounds foster health and the kisses foster corruption. That's why humble people aren't always what we think they ought to be. They can be disagreeable when the truth is valued over some relational false harmony. They can seem to be prideful when they're unsubmissive, but they're unsubmissive because of the glory of God is what is at stake. Their company can be unpleasant, even undesired, when their wounding words are kinder than selfish flattery or silence. Humble people, when the glory of God is at stake and the spiritual life and health of another is at stake, they can feel very offensive. So what is the message for today? Overall, walk humbly. This is the kind of people God is calling us to be here in 1 Peter chapter 5. And it's not a new calling. It's a calling, a command that God has always made upon His people. You might recall in Micah chapter 6, verse 8, He has showed you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. God wants us to be absorbed in things more glorious than ourselves, to prefer windows to mirrors, to live counter to every culture that we find ourselves living in. And when love requires it, to give grace through words of truth, even if it seems offensive. To be humble requires a lot of grace. But the good news is that God is able to make His grace abound to us. And He offers it to us if we will but receive it. C.S. Lewis wrote, "If anyone would like to acquire humility, I can, I think, tell him the first step. The first step is to realize that one is proud, and a biggish step too. At least nothing whatever can be done before it. If you think you're not conceited, it means that you are very conceited indeed." So what can you do today? Well, recognize your pride. Recognize that your worry is a form of that pride. And so follow Peter's call. Don't worry. Be humble. Why? Because God cares for you. So if you'll please bow your heads as someone comes to lead you in prayer.